May it please the court, Armand Abiri on behalf of the appellants. At this time, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. After watching the previous arguments, I'm reluctantly approaching the court. I'm not sure if I can offer any further insight on the newly enacted Section 1605 capital A. There are certain distinctions between the previous case and the current case before the court. The first obvious distinction is that there has been no motion filed by the appellees, LRA, in this case, arguing that the court is without jurisdiction. I believe they have sent a letter to the court arguing that the issues may be moot and they have a preference for a remand, but I don't believe there's a motion arguing that the court is without jurisdiction.
But that's a matter we have to resolve.
Yes, Your Honor. My argument...
That distinction falls away pretty quickly. Move on to the next one.
Furthermore, there is no motion that has been filed before the district court as required by the new amendment to the FSIA Section 1605 capital A, requesting that the new statute be applied. I'm sure it will be, but there is no such motion. Now, coming back to the jurisdiction of this court, I have to agree with the previous counsel for the appellants who argued that this court is obviously with jurisdiction. The section speaking or changing the provisions for interlocutory appeal under Section 1291, which now is only under Section 1292B, it says appeal may be taken. So this appeal was filed prior to the amendment of this action. The appeal is properly before the court, Your Honor.
So in that respect, you adopt the argument made by Mr. Bemis.
Yes, Your Honor.
You could do worse.
Thank you, Your Honor. Furthermore, even if the new statute was applied, it is Libya's position that in that case it would require absolute reversal of the district court in this case. The new Section 1605A has further limitations on who may be the claimants. It does add certain provisions for what damages may be awarded. However, it does further limit specifically who the claimants are that may assert causes of action previous to this court. The Section 1605 capital A, small a, is not very different. Then when we get capital A, small a, 1, when we get to capital A, small a, 2, claims which may be heard under the previous Section 1605A7 and under this section, the statute talks about limitations of who may bring causes of action and certain conditions which must be fulfilled before the court may hear these claims. In the previous one, there was some similarities where either the claimant or the victim had to be United States nationals. If the act occurred in the territory of the defendant, there had to be a opportunity for arbitration. The new statute, however, under section, if I hope I get this correctly, capital A, small a, 2C. I don't know what your physical statute looks like, but that's on page 2 of mine, which I believe was provided in the letter by the appellees. That speaks to the private right of action. A foreign state that is or was a state-sponsored terrorism, as described in section A2AI, and our official employee. And then it lists four categories of claimants which may bring private right of action against a foreign sovereign. And that one, number one, is a national of the United States, clearly speaking about an individual. And national of the United States, as we argued in our previous brief, is a defined term, which means a citizen of the United States is part of the Immigration Act. Number two, a member of the armed forces. Number three, an employee of the government of the United States or an individual performing a contract awarded by the United States government acting within the scope of the employees or employment, or for a legal representative, either one, two, or three. None of the three specific claimants under Section C for private right of action are third-party insurance claimants, Your Honor. Under Section A7, the old one, or under the new amendment. The new amendment is actually, I believe, more helpful to Libya if the plaintiffs do decide to go back and file a motion. There is no provision whatsoever. There is a new provision under Section D of that same subsection, which allows for additional damages. Also, subsection C speaks about some new damages, economic damages, salation, pain and suffering, and punitive damages, and then Section D, which speaks about additional damages. But additional damages does not address the issue of private right of action. Those are additional damages. I believe that's an attempt by Congress to overturn the Sisipia
Plea. Your argument, if I have it correctly, yes, is not that there is not a private right of action, but that it cannot be assigned to any someone other than the enumerated category of claimant.
That is correct, Your Honor.
The argument boils down to whether it's an assignable claim or not.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Or whether the assigned claim can be heard.
Yes. Essentially, I would be repeating myself at this point, repeating most of the arguments that were previously made. I would be happy to address the Section 1605A7 arguments, as well as the subsidiary issue of the question of the court, district court, taking personal jurisdiction over the individual defendants. There's a certain amount of question, as argued by the appellees, whether that issue is properly before the court. If I may address the specific facts of the case, and this is replayed.
Before you go on.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did you anywhere, or can you now tell me what possible reason the Congress could have for acting as you understand them to have acted by limiting, by preventing an assignee from pursuing the claim?
It would be extremely presumptuous for me to stand before the court and say what Congress
All
is thinking.
All presumptuous.
You have to have intended something by your account. I mean, if the claim is assignable and the assignee, well, of course, assignable, if the assignee can pursue the claim, no explanation is needed because that's the normal situation. But this would be a departure from the norm, and I'm wondering what possible intent we could a tribute to the Congress to explain that.
Well, it would not, first, Your Honor. I respectfully disagree that it is a departure from the norm. Under the FSIA, and the Supreme Court has spoken clearly on this issue on numerous occasions, the subject matter jurisdiction of the district court can only exist under the FSIA and nothing else. Assignment, subrogation, indemnification, all those issues are state law, either contract or common law issues. The Supreme Court is clear. Before the court, the district court, can hear any claims, it must ascertain its own jurisdictional competence under the FSIA. And the FSIA is the sole basis for that. Until 1996, where the terrorism amendment, the initial terrorism amendment under 1605A7 was brought, the only exceptions were arbitration exceptions, waiver, and commercial acts. Under this one, I believe it's an issue of first impression, whether I don't believe the statute, either 1605A7, the original, or the newly enacted 1605A, allow the specific languages of the statute allows any third-party corporate claimants to be allowed, whether they're the proper, there's proper assignment, subrogation, indemnification claims. There has to be subject matter jurisdiction first.
So if the victim remained the nominal plaintiff, but the real party in interest is the assignee, then what?
There is no subject matter jurisdiction. The statute provides no basis for the district court, the specific language of it, or the legislative history, Your Honor. The legislative history in the appellee's brief relating back to Section 1605A7, the previous amendment to the 1996 amendment to the FSIA, they rely extensively on the Hartford decision. And the Hartford decision and this recent decision by the district court in this case, there's some serious contradictions. They relate back to, assuming that the specific language of the statute does not allow it, the court goes back and looks at the legislative history of this case. And both of the sections that were cited, both by the Hartford case as well as this case here, and the Hartford case is the one that was relied on, do not speak to corporate third-party claimants. The victims...
But at the same time, you seem to concede that the family member could bring this case.
Under this, the family members can, but subject matter jurisdiction is a limitation on the power of the court to decide.
So why is the family member in a different position than the corporate SMA?
Well, because the statute says so, Your Honor.
Well,
under the interpretation of the FSIA, Your Honor, all courts have said that the FSIA is a restrictive statute to start. So if the statute does not speak, and the language, the limitation language, speaks only to individuals who may bring claims.
So is your distinction between natural persons and corporations or between family members and everyone else?
Yes, Your Honor. There is a clear distinction both in the statute as well as the legislative history speaking to victims, family
yes,
members. I misunderstood your question.
Are you drawing a distinction between natural persons who may sue and corporations who may not, or between family members, who of course are natural persons, but a smaller group, on the one hand, and everybody else, whether corporate or natural, on the other?
No, I am drawing a distinction in this case, Your Honor, because the family members are... there are no family members at this in this case. I am making a distinction between the corporate and individual claimants or their individual representatives or family members.
Okay, so it's
you're
trying to rule out.
Yes, sir. I apologize. I misunderstood your initial question.
And the basis for that again is the words.
One, the restrictive language of Section 1605A7, the initial one, as well as the Section 1605. Capital A, which seems to be more restrictive.
And what's the phrase in the new statute?
In the new statute, Your Honor, if you refer to Section 1605, capital A, small a, 2C, private right of action, a national of the United States, 2, a member of the armed forces, 3, an employee of the government of the United States or individual performing a contract awarded by the United States government acting within the scope of the employees or employment, or 4, which says a legal representative, 1, 2, or 3.
Shouldn't the legal representative be an artificial?
A state representative? A state representative is clearly allowed for under the new statute. A corporate third-party claimant is not, Your Honor.
It says the legal representative.
Unless the court is arguing as making the presentation that a foreign French insurance company under rights of subrogation has become somehow the representative of the victims, then the answer is clearly.
What do you take the meaning of legal representative to be?
A state representative.
Up with why you take it that way.
An estate representative, Your Honor.
Now that the normal language, as I understand it, in common law, on that is the personal representative when you're referring to. Conservator or the estate personal representative is the term that's usually used. Now, administrator of an estate, executor under a will, the term legal representative is not precisely the same term. Are you saying that it is narrowed to the definition of personal representative or that it is?
I would argue that it is the personal representative.
But why is it not used? Why is that term not used then? It's a term of art that our court has misconstrued before, but assuming we get it right this time, why would they not have said personal representative if they meant executive, administrator, or conservator?
Well, even assuming legal representative is more expansive than a personal representative, in this case, the insurance company is not a legal representative.
Wouldn't a subrogee be something that someone might deem to be a legal representative.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Sub-regie, would that not conceivably be within the definition of legal representative?
No, Your Honor. That is a contractual and a common law basis where LRA steps into the shoes and has the same rights.
Absolutely true.
But it's not a legal representative.
That still brings me back to the question, why could that not be within the term legal representative?
It could be, Your Honor. If it could be. However, that does not fit LRA in this case.
All of this is under, as you said, the question, or the heading of private right of action.
Yes, sir.
Who has private right of action?
Yes, Your Honor.
So I don't see how it stands as a limitation on who can pursue the claim.
Mm-hmm.
As long as the private right of action accrues to one of these persons. And it was a national of the United States whose claim we're talking about, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor, but
so,
once
so
again.
So the right of action, that person, and it comes within this section, and now the question we're back to is whether it can be assigned, pursued by the SMA.
Once again, I would argue that there is no subject matter jurisdiction for a district court for assignment within the language of the statute, Your Honor. Even assuming that, Your Honor, that LRA, the appellees, would fit in within the private right of action as a legal representative or through sub, there is no provision within the FSIA for subrogation, indemnification, contribution. There's no mention of it in legislative history. Your Honor, I see my time is up, if I may finish that thought. There is no record of it within the statute, and the FSIA is a restrictive statute limiting the jurisdiction of the courts in what they can and cannot hear in actions against a foreign state. And that has been the practice since 1976, and prior to that, the jurisdiction was expansive at that point, however, the courts would take the recommendation of the State Department and would relinquish jurisdiction.
And suppose the plaintiff in this case assigns the claim back to the victim.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the victim files under the new statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
Any barrier to that?
To be honest, I'm not prepared to answer that, give you an educated answer on that. I would have to research the issue. Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honors, may it please the Court. My name is Christopher Kendi, and I'm here on behalf of the appellees, La Réunion Aérienne, which is the group of French insurers that have paid a substantial portion of the claims of the individuals. I have a couple of things to cover. I don't want to rehash the issue of whether this court has jurisdiction. I would adopt Mr. Perley's argument, although I did want to read something from the legislative history that section, which is the F section, I believe, according to legislative history, was included, I'm quoting, third, state sponsors of terrorism, such as Libya, which is still responsible for terrorist acts it committed in the past, have consistently abused the appeals process to delay litigation proceedings. Third, and referring to the statute, it will limit the number of appeals that the terrorist states can pursue in U.S. courts. So this is in the legislative history, Your Honor, which is the congressional record for dated August 2nd, 2007, for S-10793.
So is that on the floor?
It was Mr. Lautenberg must have said it. I don't know if it was oral or just put in part of the record. So we think that the and just to go back to Article 3, Section 2 very briefly on the issue of whether Congress can limit or extend jurisdiction. Clearly, it can extend jurisdiction. We have the example of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act itself, which extended jurisdiction to the federal courts to hear actions against sovereigns or within certain exceptions. Congress can extend jurisdiction in admiralty cases, and they can restrict jurisdiction. And we think that this statute takes away the appellate jurisdiction in collateral situations. And I don't want to go through the whole history again. But I do want to mention the fact that I think we were under the wrong section of the statute when we were discussing Mr. DeBerry's analysis. Maybe this is a simplistic view, and maybe I'm not as sophisticated as some of the other people who have argued here, but it seems to me we have a situation where under the refiling section, which is the one we've been through several times, which is in C. It's the subsection C, application to pending cases. Basically, it says, and it is mandatory, the language says that prior actions, including actions on appeal, with respect to any action that was brought under 1605A7, that's our case, in which such action relied upon such provision as creating a cause of action. That's our case. We did not assert a federal cause of action because we didn't think we had one under CCPO Apuello. Has been adversely affected on the grounds that either or both of these provisions failed to create a cause of action against the state. And four, as of such date of enactment is before the courts in any form, including an appeal, that action and any judgment in that action shall, on motion made by plaintiffs, be given effect as if the action had been brought under the new section. So what does that do? Once we make that motion within 60 days, which we are going to do, you are popped into what I would submit is a section that Mr. DeBerry did not refer to, which is large Roman 2 of section A. You have A. This reminds me of a tax course I took once. I must say this statute is probably like the tax code in certain respects. You look at section A, 2, and then large Roman 2, which begins in the case of an action that is refiled under this section by reason of section 1083C3, which is the section I just read. So we are, as of the date we file our motion, which we intend to do, we couldn't do, the statute was just passed and we didn't have time to do it yet, but we will. We are under this section Roman 2, which basically says that...
excuse me a second.
Yes, sir.
You said that when you just marched us through a previous section, that was not C3. That was
C2.
No wonder I couldn't find it.
Yeah. I'm sorry, say that.
That was C2A that you were reading to us.
That was C2A, correct. C2A. And I think once you make a... I'm sorry?
And now you're quoting a reference to C3.
No, now I'm talking... The reference I have now is in the earlier part of the statute under A, 2, large Roman 2, which says in the case of an action that is refiled, which is what we're going to do when we make our motion by reason of section 1083C3 of that act. The foreign state was designated as a state sponsor of terrorism at the time, and that's our case. The claimant or the victim was, at the time of the act described, a national of the United States. The claimant is LRA, but it doesn't have to be a national of the United States. Only the victim has to be a national of the United States, which is what we've argued in our briefs and set forth, and which Judge Hogan agreed with in the Hartford case. So long as there is a victim that's a U.S. national, we can be a claimant if we own the claim, which we do. There's no debate, no dispute that we paid the monies for purposes at least of this appeal, that we obtained assignments, that we stepped into the shoes of the victims, and that we own the claims to the extent of amounts paid. Now, why would we do this? There are a number of reasons, Your Honors. First of all, the other section that Mr. DeBerry did not...
Why would we do this? What?
Make this motion to be refiled.
Okay.
Because there was some concern about continuing under the old statute, Judge, so I wanted to make that clear. If the court continues to look at Section D, right below the private right of action, Section C, which Mr. DeBerry referred to, it says additional damages. After an action has been brought under subsection C, actions may also be brought for reasonably foreseeable property loss, whether insured or uninsured, third-party liability, and loss claims under life and property insurance policies by reason of the same acts on which the action under subsection C is based.
I'm sorry, I didn't find it. Where is it?
I'm sorry, this is Section D, Your Honor.
It is 5AD.
You're right above special masters on the...
Correct. Yes. There's special masters, and then it's right above the appeal section, which is F, and this is D, additional damages, Your Honor. It would be...
Private right of action is C and has subsections,
correct.
And then you've got a D, additional damages.
That's correct. So we contend, Your Honor, that we did not... We do not believe that our claim as assignee and an entity which basically is standing in the shoes of the victims is barred under the statute. We actually don't think there's jurisdiction to consider that here because we think the standing issue, which is what this is a collateral decision that's not within the collateral order exception. So we're not sure the court has jurisdiction to adjudicate that issue, which to me is a standing issue, not a foreign sovereign immunity issue. But whether or not that issue is within the court's jurisdiction under the collateral order doctrine, we think D completely moots it, because it expressly addresses third-party claims, and it also addresses property claims, which is another very significant difference for us. My client paid approximately $34 million for the loss of the hull of the aircraft, as well as repatriation expenses and certain other expenses relating to the victims. We do not have a claim against Libya under the old statute. It was dismissed by the district court because the old statute only allowed for claims for personal injury or death. We now have a property claim created by this statute, that section, which is another reason why there's no question that we have an obligation to make our motion to refile and reallege a property claim. We did not have a punitive damage claim against Libya because the statute told us we couldn't assert one. We withdrew that. We now have one under the new statute. We're going to make our... Excuse me?
How does a property insurer have...
Well, we stand in the shoes of the victims. So, Your Honor, we would assert that we own the claim and we are as if we were the victims. And the fact that we are an assignee doesn't affect our right to make a property damage claim, particularly in light of this language.
But punitive damage.
Punitive damage. I'm sorry. Punitive. Well, we're asserting the right as the assignee of the victims because we stand in their shoes.
And is the assignor insured... to the extent that it would be entitled to those punitive damages?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you...
Would the assignor be entitled to those punitive damages under the contract of insurance?
Our contention would be that we own the claim to the extent of the amounts paid, and that therefore, if they have a claim for punitive damages over and above the amounts paid, they would be entitled to that, but we would be entitled to the extent of the amounts that we paid, because we own that claim to the extent of amounts paid. We paid the hull. We actually took a bill of sale as part of the payment to the owner of the hull. So
you're not claiming anything that would not accrue ultimately to the insured?
That's correct. Well, we're claiming only in the shoes of the insured. Yeah, we're not claiming as an insurer directly for punitive damages. That's correct, Your Honor. So in any event, I think the point I'm trying to make is that the issue that's on the appeal that the court is considering today is mooted out by Section D and by the fact that we're going to refile under the provision which allows us to make our motion within 60 days, and that I don't think the court really has anything to consider at this point. There was another issue which I almost forgot. The statute expressly creates vicarious liability for employees or agents of Libya. It's another rule that didn't exist before. So we are now going to add a claim for vicarious liability as a result of the actions of the agents of Libya in blowing up flight UTA 772. So there are a whole variety of rights and claims that we now have that we didn't have before. So whether the court decides that it should dismiss the appeal because it doesn't have jurisdiction, or that the appeal is moot because we're now under a completely different legislative scheme, one provision of which moots the issue on appeal, which is the standing of LRA to bring these claims, we would prefer the dismissal. We don't think there's jurisdiction, but we would also urge the court, in lieu of dismissing, to remand the case for further consideration, given the fact that we are now going to be in a whole different legislative environment. It's a sea change, as we mentioned in our letter. Just see if I have covered everything else. Briefly on the service issue against the individuals, we don't think that case is properly before the court. If the court looks at the notice of appeal, they will see that the individual defendants did not notice this appeal. It was noticed exclusively by Libya and the government agency LISO. They're not in this appeal, and as a consequence of which, we don't think that the court has jurisdiction over the service on the individual defendants. Moreover, we believe that service issue is a classic case of the finality rule, and it's not appropriate for consideration on under the collateral order exception. Addressing the substantive issue of this appeal taking away the whole sea change issue, we think that it's very clear that the language, which is very similar to the language in the new statute, the victim or the claimant has to be a U.S. national. There's nothing in the statute that says that a U.S. national has to be an individual. In fact, I could think of many situations where a bank, Chase Manhattan Bank, could be the executor of a victim. And under Mr. DeBeer's reading of the statute, Chase Manhattan Bank could not bring an action as the executor of one of the victims of this act because it wasn't an individual. That's, I think, a nonsense argument. So our view is that under the current statute, the issue is not appropriate for consideration because it's a standing issue, but in any event, because of the oral language in the statute, we stand in the shoes. The victims are U.S. nationals. We have the right to assert a claim under the exception against Libya, and I thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Give you a minute, Mr. DeBeer.
Thank you, Your Honor. Several issues that were brought up by my esteemed counsel over there. The first issue of standing, that is an issue that is just brought up in appeal, and I think as a red herring. Standing was not asserted before the district court. It was not argued before the district court. And
I think you misapprehend Mr. Kennedy's argument. He's saying that your argument is attacking standing while couched in other terms. And what you're really saying is that they don't have standing. He's also saying that's not the proper subject for interlocutory appeal.
Well, standing is not, I agree that standing is not a proper issue
what
for interlocutory
appeal. What do you say to his proposition that the gist of your argument is standing rather than anything normally
heard? I respectfully argue that he is incorrect. Even if it is a standing issue and district court did not decide sovereign immunity, that is, once again, a reversible error. Every circuit case, as well as the Supreme Court, has said that, I see my time is up. Once again, may I finish? That this courts are under an independent obligation, even if not raised by the defendants, to at the threshold of every case to determine their own jurisdiction.
There's
to hear
no question about that.
Yes, Your Honor.
But normally, if this were not an FSIA case, if this were a tort claim case, and the court denied a motion to dismiss on standing, we usually wouldn't see that absent a certification until after a merits decision.
Absolutely, Your Honor. However, it is an FSIA.
What he's saying is that what you're attacking here is really standing rather than sovereign immunity.
I would have to disagree with that. We are arguing whether or not the district court has the judicial power to even hear cases, whatever it may be, standing or not, Your Honor. And that has to be a threshold issue, and that is a denial. And Libya's motion was a motion 12B1 for lack of subject matter jurisdiction for foreign sovereign immunity under the previous section 1605A7. We didn't even approach the issue of standing. The district court fails to discuss it even in a single instant. I have one more subject, if I may finish. I didn't have a chance to. On the issue of service, the district court has ordered that has allowed Mr. Kennedy to serve me despite the stipulation agreed to by Mr. Kennedy, ordered by the court, and as represented by me, that I do not represent these individual defendants. I'm not their counsel. I haven't been retained by them. And Mr. Kennedy is absolutely correct. They're not on the notice of appeal. They're not my clients. I can't make an appeal on their behalf, Your Honor.
We have that argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, gentlemen, both. Case is submitted.